Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Want to talk to Alex Worth. He's a Bay Area-based researcher, writer, organizer, whose work sits at the intersection of police, surveillance, housing justice, and urban policy. He spent years documenting how law enforcement practices shape everyday life in marginalized communities, with a particular focus on Los Angeles and Oakland. He has recently put out a book. It is called On Loop: Black Sonic Politics in Oakland. It's generating a lot of buzz. It focuses a lot on the music expression, especially among Black people in this city. But it's also a deep dive into the politics and the policies that have come to shape this area, and makes for not only an interesting read, but a lot of insight of some of the stories that we know and love. The battle that, for example, that Jeffrey's Inner Circle encountered with the police at the dawn of Jerry Brown becoming the mayor, the Barbecue Becky situation at Lake Merritt, and a rich history of the battle of Black expression and it going up against the powers that be from the days of people migrating to Oakland all the way up to now. So, Alex, welcome to the show. Glad to have you. And you start off the book by talking about the drum circles at Lake Merritt. And let's kick it off there. Lake Merritt has been a very contested space from the days that I moved here in the 80s all the way up to now. This very moment, it's still contested space. Talk about what you found in your research and the people you talked to. And, let's take this contested space with you opening up with the drum circle, but also looking at what's existed before these drummers came here.
Yeah, absolutely. And if I may also say, Davey, thank you so much for having me on the show. I mean, you and I didn't get a chance to talk during the research, but I've been a close follower of your journalism and your analysis for a long time. And I think it's reflected a lot in these pages. And I bring that up now because in thinking about Lake Merritt, so I was a PhD student in the geography department at UC Berkeley. And we can get into maybe more a little bit later about how I came to this project. But, I basically was starting my field research on, trying to think about what is the place of Black cultural production and expression in Oakland, both within like contemporary struggles over gentrification and displacement, but also the long, important arc of the Black freedom movement in the city. And this was like, I was just starting my research in like 2015. And at that moment, there was one of these instances where things kind of pop off around people's ability to hang out at the lake. And I think what was happening right at that time was that the Oakland Police Department started kind of increasing their patrols around the east side of the lake along Lakeshore and started ticketing people over super minor violations of the law. And I actually remember, and part of the pretext for that was that was allegedly a no cruising zone. There's a signpost that said no cruising, right? And that goes
Right.
back to the 90s, and I talk about that in the book. And I remember that you posted something on Facebook basically saying, like, we as Black Oaklanders, we can read between the lines. Like this is basically saying no Negroes allowed. And I just thought that that was so insightful for me. One, certainly in terms of just being able to sit, read between the lines when someone says, oh, this is about public drinking, this is about noise, this is about barbecuing, being like, we really know that this is racialized, but also that it harkens back to a much longer, enduring and honestly looping history of using these kinds of laws and practices to disrupt the ability of Black people to gather in public space in Oakland, but across the country writ large, whether that goes back to Jim Crow, that's what I was sort of hearing in sort of like your invocation, or of course even earlier into things like the Black codes and such like that. So that got me really thinking, like, man, Lake Merritt is this space where every couple of years, sometimes every couple of months, something happens. And maybe it's about drum circles, maybe it's about barbecuing, maybe it's about people playing their stereos. But one way or another, it kind of it's a part of this long-standing looping trajectory of basically trying to disrupt the ability of Black people to gather in that marquee public space.
Very true. For me, when I put up that Facebook post, it was a reminder that this was nothing new. And the only thing that had changed was maybe what people were using as a pretense, to get rid of black folks. At that point in time, they were preemptively putting up the signs to say no barbecuing, right? And but prior to that, they were going after people for skateboarding. Then they were going after people for bike riding. It was always something. And as you point out in the books, there's been this long battle of nuisance laws that have been disproportionately applied. That's what I found fascinating. And that these laws had been in place almost from the times that people got off the trains and migrated here to Oakland. So let's talk a little bit about that, because that seems to be the overarching theme in this book, black expression and white repression, and double standards in how these laws get applied. So let's go back into time and talk about this pitch battle that has always existed, starting back in the days of the blues in West Oakland.
Many of your listeners may know that, it's so interesting. Like, Oakland is iconic in terms of its role in Black American politics and cultural production. And we think of it as an historically Black city, but that's actually a relatively recent phenomenon in the kind of grand arc of American history. Like, at the beginning of the 20th century, there were only an estimated 1,000 Black people in Oakland. So it really began to change, as many people may know, during World War II, that period that historians call the Second Great Migration, when the massive infusion of federal funds in the wartime shipbuilding industries in the Bay Area, and especially in the East Bay, we're talking like Oakland, Alameda, Richmond, Vallejo. That was a moment in which suddenly there was a lot of job opportunities for people who, at that very moment and for decades preceding it, had really needed some kind of escape from the racial terrorism of the South, right? So Oakland, in particular, attracted a lot of Black folks from not just the kind of the South, but also sort of the creeping into the Southwest, Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana. And because of the kind of structure of segregation that existed at that time and the need to be kind of close to the working waterfront where a lot of the job opportunities were, that's when West Oakland really became the arrival point for so many Black migrants. And what you see when you go kind of back into that history was that the forms of expression that Black folks from the South and Southwest carried with them as rural people, as Southerners, as people steeped in more of a kind of country blues tradition, that those forms of cultural and sonic expression became kind of central to the sort of moral panic that came to emerge around Black migration to Oakland. So the blues clubs in West Oakland, the ways that people express themselves, whether how they dressed or how they sounded, on streetcars or in public space, going shopping in downtown Oakland and things like that, that really became one of the central sites that the authorities honed in on in order to try to keep these Black folks in line. And that really ended up having a negative impact on the nightclubs and venues that popped up all along 7th Street and throughout West Oakland. So it's a time, I think this really sets the stage for the kind of drama of the next sort of 7 or 8 decades of history that this book tells, where we're looking at simultaneously Oakland being a place of incredibly rich Black cultural expression, where the kind of the nightlife, the sounds, the community gathering spaces are key not only to kind of cultural resilience and community survival, but also as a real source of economic opportunity. And that with that, that's met in a really recurring, looping way by this kind of stigma and these inequitable regulations.
Alex Worth is our guest, talking about his book, which is called On Loop: Black Sonic Politics in Oakland. When, if you close your eyes and just read the book, well, you gotta keep your eyes open, but if you just read the book and didn't know what years, you didn't know what chapter you were in, you might think what was going on in the 40s and 50s was today. Almost with the same characters. You talked about a moral panic expressed by a lot of non-blacks, a lot of white folks upset with the music, the expression, but also simultaneously, you point out that there was a middle class or an existing class of black folks that also frowned upon it. These country folks are too crazy. I don't like it. It's, respectability politics. And you see that playing out as for as long as I've known. As long as I've been here, there's always been a contingent of folks that are like, if you just would keep the noise down, if you would just stop the drumming, everything would be all right.
Right.
And that would just kind of booster the type of racial animosity that would be, to me, the goal of folks who were putting laws into place. So I say all this because the thing that also stands out is that almost immediately you started having laws and different types of enforcement around these expressions. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think that frame of respectability politics is so key, right? And that is, and it, I don't, I, you know, honestly, it's, you know, also like as a Jewish person and knowing the history of my people in this country, I can also say that, you know, this is not just strictly unique to the African American community, where you have some group of folks who are marginalized by white supremacy, who are looking for that toehold within a system that damns them. And that often looks like some kind of form of assimilation, right? So there is that, and there's, you know, I can understand that, but it also, I think, you know, begs for kind of an understanding of things like that when we're talking about kind of an analysis of the cultural politics of race, like just talking about race alone is never enough, right? We have to think about age. We have to think about class. We have to think about things like who's a property owner and who's not, who's been in a certain place for a long time and who's a relatively recent migrant, right? So the analysis, I think, I hope in this book is a little more intersectional in that way. But yeah, it was really interesting for me to notice the ways that, you know, you had a kind of established black middle and political class in the 1940s and 50s who were sort of participating in the moral panic over Southern and Southwestern black migrants. And then, you know, if you fast forward, let's say 50 years and think about, maybe we'll get into it, the moral panic around sideshows, for instance, then again, you're dealing with a kind of black political leadership in the city and more middle class black property owners and business owners who are also, again, very concerned about what the youth are doing.
Right. But at the same time, and this is why I said you close, proverbially close your eyes, you don't know whether you're talking about the 50s or now, because they talk about crime waves, all these different things like the bad audiences that were coming. We need to ban the music and ban the clubs. And I'm like, well, just to kind of give a little bit of context. You talk about the drum circles here. You also talk about a very famous incident or infamous incident with Samba Funk, who you're very close with, which was also at the lake, which involved drumming. And, one resident who just newly came to the Bay Area, who called the police and then came down there and assaulted people. And then the next, the pictures I was there that night, they had like 10 to 14 police cars there,
That's right. That's right.
keeping everybody from enjoying the. I think it was like a rare blue moon or a red moon that night.
I think they called it the blood moon. It's
The blood moon,
total
the blood
lunar
moon.
eclipse.
Yeah. And so you had drumming at the Jewish Cultural Center that's right across the street from me. You had Korean folks drumming. You had everybody was out, but this guy went over to Samba Funk. And so as I'm reading this, you have these modern incidents. But then I'm also like, you're also taking us into the past. And that's why I was like, wow, okay, this. What year are we in?
It is disorienting, isn't it?
Right? It is disorienting because
Yes.
it's the same rhetoric and the
Right.
same outcome.
Right. And just, you know, to put a fine point on it, like that's why the book is called On Loop. It's not the only reason, and maybe we can talk about kind of the importance of different kinds of looping practices within black dance music and sonic culture. But it's also about the kind of repetitiveness of history. Right, both the repetitiveness of anti-black racism and the way that it's played out in Oakland and beyond, but also the endurance of black Oaklanders, the ways that Black folks from Oakland continuously draw upon these rich cultural lineages of how to inhabit or occupy public space, how to bring their cultural practices out into the public realm as a way of kind of sort of using sound and movement as a way of claiming, staking a claim on belonging, right? So it's both. But yes, I think that there is something really disorienting around time, and that's what I felt, you know, living in the city for over a decade, working on this project for about as long, you know, it was kind of like I never really knew where I was in time exactly. And for me, that actually became exactly the point, right? That these things sort of things transect time, and that if we want to understand them, and more importantly, if we want to change them, that we need to kind of understand the longer history. And so just to give you one example of that, because you brought up the drumming, you know, like yes, with that Samba Funk incident, and shout out to Samba Funk and my fellow dancers and teachers over there, you know, that got understood, I think, really for reasons that make a lot of sense, as being like, you know, here is this gentrifier coming in and kind of exerting his white privilege. And being like, you know, there was a culture here before you arrived, right? And that is certainly what was going on. That is true. But what I also came to realize because of the kind of deep archival work that I was doing as a part of my research was that the actual laws around banning drumming at the lake that this guy, whether knowingly or not, was invoking, they were actually passed in 1976, kind of the sort of tail end of the kind of like funk era in Oakland when there was a lot of barbecuing and public gathering happening in Lakeside Park. And there were residents over there complaining over there about the sound of people playing bongos and congas in the park and things like that. And so that's actually when the Oakland City Council first passed this requirement that you need to have a permit in order to drum around the lake. And so I just think that it asks, it kind of begs a different set of questions when we're like, okay, well that wasn't gentrification. We're talking 1976. So then what are we talking about? And that's why I think, you know, getting really serious about the kind of stigma and pushback and impulse towards policing that exists around Black sonic expression, like that's why I think that's so important, because it's never just about gentrification alone.
In reading it, reading the book, the question that comes to mind, how much of this complaining, which resulted in laws and bannings, in disproportionate enforcement with overhyped? And here's why I ask this question. If you say sideshows to people now, right? People will go, well, you know, the cars are out there, they're making noise and blah, 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 right? And you can point and say, this is just terrible. And you can maybe look at an example and say, okay. But when we're talking about stuff in the 50s and the 70s, there's now a nostalgia, even by the people who would complain about things today, right? They would sit there and go, you know, back when West Oakland was really a bluesy town and they had was the scene of the jazz, or in the 70s, right? I literally see people on Facebook. I remember when you could go to the lake and you could see the funk bands there on Lakeside Park and all that. And you're like, but you're the one that was complaining back then. Right. And I'll put a, you know, a book in this by pointing out UC Berkeley, since we both went to Cal. Cal in their brochures will now brag that this is the home of free speech, and it will brag that it's the home of the anti-apartheid movement, something I took real offense to because I was involved with that. And you look at that and you go, you guys directly were against divestment and all that, but now you have it in your brochure and you brag that this is the home of free speech, and yet you're kowtowing right now as we speak to the free speech restrictions put on by this current administration. But it's okay for you to say this is the home of free speech. So you also have folks that are here like, this is the home of jazz and this is the home of blues and this is the land of funk. But you were the people that were complaining about it when it was there and put laws into place to stifle it. But now you want to brag like, oh, this is This is our home. And now we're at a point where people will go, this is the home of Tupac. And this is, you know, and they can go back to the 90s where these pitch battles were happening. You're bragging about black expression and excellence and taking a bow for it and even profiting off it, which you talk about in the book. But at the same time, you were the main ringleaders trying to shut it down. Help
And
it
I'm
make
glad.
sense.
Oh, I don't know if I can make sense of it, but only in the way that racism doesn't make sense, right, Davey? So I'm glad you brought up the Tupac thing, because yeah, it's like at this point, you've got the city of Oakland kind of declaring a certain day as sort of Tupac Shakur Day, but like Tupac also sued the OPD for millions of dollars for being brutalized in downtown Oakland. It's like you don't get to have it both ways, but there is a kind of historical amnesia, right, or a selective memory or something like that. And I think this is actually really central to the ways that the city of Oakland relates to black music in the town, right? Because on the one hand, the people who are responsible for redevelopment, economic development, trying to market the city, boost its property tax base, boost jobs, et cetera, like they understand that the city's appeal is inseparable from its black cultural and political history, including its musical history and its musical present, right? So they understand that, and they want to kind of capture that, harness it, and frankly commodify it. But at the same time, it's like, and I hope somebody, if you read this book, that you walk away understanding how deeply involved both the Oakland Police Department, but also the kind of civilian agencies of the city of Oakland, how deeply involved they've been in curtailing and regulating and stifling, quite frankly, black musical culture in Oakland. So it's like they view it in this kind of ambivalent way as simultaneously dangerous and desirable at the same time.
That's the voice of Alex Worth talking about his book On Loop, Black Sonic Politics in Oakland. Let's talk a little bit about chapter two and some of the expressions that emerged during the Black Power era. You start off with our colleague Ricky Vincent, who is featured prominently in the book for his work. But you also talk about these early things which become, I guess, the foundation for modern expression, the dancing that's going on, its intersection with the Panthers, Black Power, and the music change that is happening as we enter into the funk era, which, you know, people love funk, but I'm old enough to remember when people thought it was, you know, abhorrent. But now we love funk, right? Now we wish George Clinton could come back to the
It's like you were
park and
just
fly
talking about.
stone, right? But you hated those guys. You banned James Brown from downtown, which they did, right? But you love James Brown now. But talk a little bit about this, that chapter.
Sure, yeah, thank you. And I'm glad you brought up Ricky Vincent, because he was a huge, huge inspiration for me here. And what I mean by that is that, I tried to read everything I could get my hands on when it comes to writing about the Black Panthers and Black Power writ large in Oakland in the late 1960s and early 1970s, right? And there's such a rich historiography from that period, or dealing with that period, right? So we know really well about kind of everything that the Black Panthers were up to in Oakland, ranging from kind of fighting against urban renewal to the survival programs to the food giveaways in D'Infirmary Park to eventually transitioning into electoral politics. Like, this history is really well known. And then on the other hand, there's maybe another literature, probably smaller, that deals with some of the forms of artistic and cultural expression that was sort of articulating Black power, but in a more cultural vein during the same period. And what I think was so remarkable about Ricky's scholarship and his writing in the book Party Music was bringing those two things together to show how inseparable they were, especially through the work of the band The Lumpin', who, if folks don't know, was basically like the house band for the Black Panther Party, that was made up of rank and file members, who also happened to be very talented musicians, right? So I think with his kind of insight as a jumping off point, I wanted to kind of write about how funk culture, which comes in very significant ways from the East Bay during that time, kind of aligned with and helped to motivate the more well-known forms of political organizing during the Black Power era, right? And so when I say the funk culture is kind of rooted in the East Bay, we're talking about, Larry Graham, the bassist for Sly and the Family Stone, and then later kind of the front man for Graham Central Station, like basically created the slap bass technique, which is one of the core ingredients of the funk, like right in Oakland, right? Or you've got, again, Sly and the Family Stone, Sly Stone being from Vallejo, but a lot of East Bay musicians coming together in that really important outfit to help to kind of like launch the culture. And then I also like to I write as well about the youth street dance culture that in Oakland was known as Boogaloo, roboting in Richmond and strutting in San Francisco, but Boogaloo in Oakland. And basically, the argument that I'm trying to make is that sometimes these young folks were directly involved in the Panthers, right? You see that in the Lumpen. You can see that in some of the Boogaloo groups. Like the Black Resurgence used to open up at Panther rallies and stuff like that, or perform at the Black Panther Party's community school in East Oakland. But oftentimes they were just kind of indirectly aligned with the spirit of Black Power. That these things like the kind of hard dancing, the kind of freedom that came through self-expression, on a funky dance floor, or if you were part of a Boogaloo crew, that in a lot of ways these were taking the more abstract goals of the Black Power movement, things like freedom, expression, self-determination, and kind of rooting them in everyday culture and in the bodies of East Bay Black youth.
Real talk, the funk movement itself, what were the challenges that these bands faced? I mean, we know the big ones, the Sly Stones and what have you, but there were hundreds of funk bands here, literally. That was what I always found fascinating was, why we had hundreds of crews, hip hop crews in New York simultaneously. You had hundreds of everybody was trying to be in a band. everybody was a good musician, and this was kind of frowned on. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I do think it's really, we were talking earlier about the kind of idea of respectability, and what counts as respectable changes from one moment to the next. So yeah, so the kind of like the out there style, the kind of alignment with psychedelic culture, the sort of like sometimes like sexual explicitness of funk musicians, like that was the, in some ways it was the like the hip hop of its time, right? It was hip hop before hip hop, right? And so, people who were maybe more into jazz music at that point might think, oh, they frown on these kinds of forms of like very liberated expression, right? But then they forget, as you were saying, that that's what jazz music had been 30, 40 years earlier. And again, that's what like hip hop would be 10, 20 years and ongoingly after that. So yeah, there is this kind of cultural stigma around the liberatedness, the expressiveness of funk culture. But then, because my grounding is sort of, being sort of someone who's rooted in urban geography and urban planning, like I think a lot about urban space as well. And I don't get into this as much in the book, but I do think that one of the challenges that East Bay funk bands faced kind of during that time was also sort of a lack of venues, places to connect with audiences and to bring their work forward. And I think one of the reasons for that was that, I think in terms of Black club ownership, sort of the heyday, I think, would probably be in the World War II and post-war period in West Oakland in particular. But by the time that we get to the funk era, late 60s and 70s, we're talking about the urban renewal period. We're talking about the insertion of BART right down the middle of 7th Street, basically the planned execution of that as a Black commercial corridor, right? And so between that and redlining and disinvestment, there just really weren't as many venues for funk bands to be able to demonstrate their talent, especially like within Black communities in the East Bay. So I found it kind of interesting that like oftentimes funk bands would play like at high school auditoriums and things like that. I think part of
Right.
that was that it is kind of a youth culture and wanting to bring the music directly to young people. But I think the flip side of it is actually not having well-financed nightclubs where they could perform.
That's the voice of Alex Worth talking about his book. It is called On Loop: Black Sonic Politics in Oakland, chronicling the political backdrop as well as the music expressions that have emerged out of this city. And you have a couple of chapters that to me run simultaneously. You can maybe give us a little bit of insight into the crack, the war on nuisance, and black noise, crime, and what is it? Crime and grime.
Rhyme and grime and rhyme.
And a rhyme, right? So what are we looking at? The war on crack, the war on nuisance. You do a fascinating breakdown of windows policing,
Broken windows policing.
broken windows policing. And I did not realize how much of a foothold it had here in Oakland, even under its first black mayor, Lionel Wilson. So
That's
talk a little bit about this.
sure. Yeah. So
And
it's
I'm going to say
interesting.
something. The police have a major presence in this book. They're like in every chapter,
Oh, no doubt. No doubt.
which is something that, I mean, it's crazy to see how much of a presence that they have with black expression, ranging from surveillance all the way to bragging that they put laws on the book to curtail it. It's just crazy, and it's something that I'm still trying to wrap my head around. Like the OPD is a very insidious force.
And actually really listening to what's happening musically in the culture, and it feeds into, it's not the only basis for anti-black policing, but it feeds into it in really insidious ways, as you say. And so maybe we'll talk about some of the ways that pops up around the regulation of nightclubs in particular.
Yeah,
But
that I'm waiting to do. That's the big
cool.
chapter, yeah.
So let me talk about let me answer your previous question though. So if folks read the book, there's this kind of chapter three that might feel a little bit like a detour at first, because it's really getting into more changes in the economy and the governance of Oakland in like the 1970s and 80s. And it's not really a music or sound focused chapter, but I want to tell folks why I concluded that and why I think it sets up the kind of the rest of the analysis in the book. So this chapter is sort of dealing with the period after Black Power, and what is kind of, I think, is generally called by historians sort of the post-civil rights era. And it's just a really remarkable period in American history, and in urban history in particular. So in Oakland, we're talking about a time of really massive disinvestment, and that's talking about, businesses, factories, corporations taking their capital out of Oakland and moving it kind of further east into the East Bay or further south into Alameda County, but also widespread public disinvestment, right? We're talking about after the period of the Great Society and LBJ and kind of expanding social programs. Now we're talking about the Nixon years, moving toward the Reagan years. Right, and kind of basically, stripping funds from all kinds of public anti-poverty programs, youth development programs, and things like that. So there's just less money, period, leading to kind of more mass unemployment, and kind of widespread intergenerational poverty. And of course, this is highly racialized, highly targeted, to kind of black and brown folks in the flatlands of Oakland. And then this at the same time, we're also dealing with just the devastation of the crack epidemic, which basically feeds on that kind of produced poverty. Ironically, painfully, tragically, perhaps, this is also the period that, kind of because of white flight and also black political organizing, that this is the period in which black folks are able to kind of take over control of the city's political apparatus. So Lionel Wilson becomes mayor in 1977, and there are basically black mayors for the next 22 years. So it's like, on the one hand, this is massive, this is great, and on the other hand, they're handed the kind of the bag of having to deal with these horrible kind of compounding crises, which has honestly at many times been orchestrated at the top levels of the federal government. So then what is there to do about it, right? This is like a really precarious time. I'd never want to minimize that. And generally speaking, I think what we know about is kind of like people who are critically informed, historically informed, we know about the war on drugs. We know about the war on crime. We know how those sort of fit into a kind of anti-black, anti-urban agenda in this country. But I think what gets a little bit less attention is what I call in the book the war on nuisance. So what's nuisance? I mean, nuisance is a kind of category, a legal category. It shows up a lot if you end up reading, like I do, if you end up reading city ordinances and stuff like that. It's basically anything that is considered to kind of bother or disturb folks, and in particular, property owners, because it really comes from property law. So that might look like things like loud noises. It might look like things like, screeching tires. It might look like public urination. These kinds of things generally get lumped under the category of nuisance, and they're considered sort of like relatively minor things, but they become a vehicle. They become a vehicle for exercising all kinds of crackdowns upon people's behavior in public. And so the argument that I'm making is that in this period, in the post-civil rights era, when you have black political leadership in Oakland City Hall and eventually in 1993 also running the OPD, like the city was looking for different kinds of ways of being able to kind of regulate and control a city that it seemed, at least to investors and the authorities, as be kind of running amok or out of control. And they couldn't do it in openly racist or racialized terms. And so instead, this idea of nuisance, that the people who are creating nuisances, became a practicable means of policing that ends up really honing in on and negatively affecting the kind of hip hop generation in particular.
That's the voice of Alex Worth. And so with the nuisance laws, could you give some examples of how that was enforced or disproportionately enacted?
Sure. So some of the examples that I talk about in the book, one is about the city of Oakland's anti-cruising campaign. So that's we're talking about car cruising, basically like people going out and kind of driving slow, either along Lakeshore, maybe Foothill Boulevard in East Oakland, wanting to show off their cars at a certain point, maybe show off their sound systems, and just like basically creating a gathering space in a city that because of disinvestment, increasingly came to lack those kinds of gathering spaces. So that became considered a huge nuisance.
And let's just put it in context. We celebrate cruising in a very nostalgic way in movie after
Oh,
movie,
yeah.
the James Deans of the world, the Happy
Right.
Days, all this. But then, when people are riding their nice cars around the lake, you put up the sign, you have this incredible enforcement of cars driving around the lake, and the whole nine.
Right. And
A nuisance.
it's a nuisance, right? And the thing is that like I looked at the ordinances, the original ordinance language, right? And what the law says basically is that like it says, well, what is a cruising zone? A cruising zone is basically any area that is affected, like unduly affected by traffic congestion. Right. So the law is written in this very vague, very general terms, but like it's like, so what? So then is the 880 a nuisance zone? Right? Because that's affected by traffic congestion. Like, is Ashby Avenue in Berkeley a nuisance? I mean, excuse me, not a nuisance zone, a cruising zone, because that's affected by traffic congestion. It's like, no, this is what I mean. So this is what I think is so important about the war on nuisance is that the language is always what's called race neutral, right? But the impact or the enforcement of it is not race neutral.
Right.
Because the only places that the city actually targeted its enforcement were Lakeshore Avenue, Foothill and MacArthur in East Oakland, like places that were basically known to be black cruising zones in particular, right? And so space is racialized. And by targeting spaces, you can actually target races while actually doing this kind of magic trick by pretending you're not doing it at all under the language of
Right.
nuisance.
I saw this kind of enforced with the critical mass bicycling that you would see in San Francisco, and everybody would celebrate it and say, these people are not driving cars, they're riding bikes, and this is good. But when the scraper bikes come along, all the police are out there, and enforcing those type of laws. And it's ironic that we had a no cruising zone around the lake. And people are being ticketed for driving too slow. That now, if you go to the lake, They took a two-lane thing and made it into one. And so guess what? You're driving real slow around the lake. But now it's okay.
The double standards
The
are
double
all over
standard.
this book.
You go into great detail about the sideshow, and giving a lot of history with that. The enforcement that comes around with Jerry Brown, and Rob Bob and all those folks. And that's something to read, but I want to get to the clubs, and Jeffrey's Inner Circle. That is a fascinating chapter, and one that I think just kind of encapsulates everything that you're talking about, and that I think many people are experiencing. Jeffrey Peet is the pinnacle of black political power in the city of Oakland. His place, Jeffrey's Inner Circle, which you described the history with, long fought, venue to get with a white owned, high end club. He gets it. And this becomes the gathering place. And you go in there, everybody from Muhammad Ali to Nelson Mandela has been to Jeffrey's. You see all the pictures on the wall. So this is what you say, this is what we need, a high end, great establishment. And I know it angered Jerry Brown. He wanted to dismantle that. I remember that. But this was not, Jeffrey's was, you went with your suit and tie on to get into Jeffrey's. So let's talk a little bit about what happened with this club, because it bleeds over into other the attack on black nightclubs in Oakland.
I think that the case of Jeffrey's Inner Circle is really exemplary of what happens to the black nightlife in Oakland. And in that chapter, I kind of tell two stories side by side. One is about Jeffrey's Inner Circle, one is about Sweet Jimmy's over on San Pablo Avenue. But in terms of Jeffrey's, yes, his club had a capacity of about 600 or 700 people. And it often, in its heyday, often filled it, right? It was the place to see and be seen. It attracted all kinds of luminaries from across politics, music, art, sports, right? And held a number of very different kinds of events. But, the story that I tell is sort of focused on the events that ha called the First Saturdays events at Jeffrey's, which were, ran for a long time, especially kind of like during the 2000s. And these were events that appealed to sort of a younger crowd. And it might be a place where, folks would go to dance to like the latest sort of slaps from the hyphy movement and things like that. And it was just a hub, in a town that was kind of desolate, and especially where young working class people of color didn't have a lot of places to gather, a lot of places to see one another, a lot of places to experience entertainment. That gathering at a place like Jeffrey's was it. And that might look like coming and going inside the club, or it might look like hanging out outside around closing time to just kind of get in on a little bit of the action. And this drove the police crazy. The way I what I show in the book also is that this is happening in the midst of a hugely expensive and intense anti-sideshow campaign that basically had the OPD looking at any kind of gathering, even a small gathering of black people on a street corner in Oakland, as a kind of sideshow in some state of formation. So the scene outside of a club like Jeffrey's got tagged as a kind of a soon-to-be sideshow, and they sent police officers out there over and over and over again. And I think another important context to
And
note.
Jeffrey's never had sideshows, by the way.
Oh yes, thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, there were no sideshows at Jeffrey's.
This is a lens. This is a lens that the
Yes.
OPD came to use increasingly, to as a way of kind of stigmatizing and therefore authorizing regulation against kind of any form of kind of black gathering in public space during that time. But the other piece of context that I think is really important is that, city planners, city officials in Oakland, around the 1990s, they basically went on the record and said, "We think that the key to revitalizing downtown Oakland is turning it into a hub of nightlife and entertainment." Okay. And so it was 20 or 30 years of concerted policy making and deep investments in trying to make that happen through things like the Fox Theater and all these other kind of marquee venues. Jeffries was making that happen, right? At the very same time that the city says that they want to get big crowds, nighttime crowds downtown, they're going after precisely nighttime crowds at Jeffries.
Right, and Jeffries moves from Jack London Square into downtown. So he's in the middle of that,
Right in the
you
middle of
know,
it.
and then you have a Jerry Brown who comes along a few years after Jeffries opens and goes, this is, we want to make this a nightlife, you know, hub, but he doesn't want that nightlife.
Yeah, just not
He
nightlife
doesn't
like
want
that.
he doesn't want Jeffries nightlife.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
So let's talk, I mean, in the book you describe how they close the garage. They make it very difficult. They start
Yes.
fining him. They start making him pay for unwarranted police activities. All this
Yeah.
crazy stuff that was going on. And he had top-notch security. You know,
He did.
he had
He did.
off-duty cops and the whole nine. So he didn't have problems.
Right.
But they still were sending people over there, like 10 and 12 cars, and then saying he had to pay the bill.
Right. Yeah, and I think this is what's so interesting about the story of Jeffries is that I want to talk about kind of two different forms of regulation that he faced. You know, one of it was the sort of like spectacularly heavy-handed approach, and the other was a much more mundane, bureaucratic, day-to-day, week-to-week kind of approach. And he was getting squeezed from both sides. So, just in terms of the more mundane kind of regulation, I show in this chapter, this is chapter six, about how in 1999, the city of Oakland passed an ordinance that basically said if the police come to your club too often, then, well, one, you're going to need to pay for it. And two, we're going to place you on what I call a form of nightlife probation, which means that even though you're a permitted venue, you're going to need to apply for a permit for every single event that you want to have, every single concert, every single DJ night that you want to have. And that permitting process is going to be run by a shop within the OPD called, that was called the Special Events Unit. And the Special Events Unit basically would have the power to look into who were the performers going to be, what kind of genre music were they going to play, what was the likely demographic of the crowd that was going to come out, and basically say, if you want a permit for that, then you're going to need extra liability insurance. You're going to need this many cops on the street in order to make it viable. You're going to need to agree to X, Y, and Z extra conditions. And so it created this whole apparatus of regulating nightlife that, even though it didn't say anything about hip hop or rap anywhere in the ordinance, of course it didn't. It couldn't be so
Right.
explicit, right? In practice, these policies only ever applied to rap events, and which most often meant an onerous and inequitable impact on Black-owned venues in particular. So the police were coming out frequently to Jeffries without being called and without really needing to, because, as you said, he had top-notch security. And then they would basically send him a bill and offload the
Right.
cost.
And the other thing that you point out, in which I remember, the police were coming there not because there were fights, but because they said they were making too much noise when they were leaving the clubs. Keep in mind, nobody lives there. You know,
Yes,
it's a
especially not
bit,
that time.
there's, yeah, nobody's living there. But this became a thing of like, well, the streets are too crowded. You have 600 people leaving at once, you know, and so they're there, and you describe like they're hanging out, they're looking at the women, they're chucking it up. They're not, you know, because everything is under control. But this was overtime pay, this was a squeeze on Jeffries, and then putting him on a probation where they get to say, well, you can't be on this radio station at the time. He couldn't advertise at KML, had to go elsewhere, and all these different
Right.
type of constrictions, you know, who's coming to town, and they're looking at the rap artists or the artists, and then declaring them, you know, problematic.
Right. And that's the mundane thing that's happening day after day, week after week. And then, and Jeffrey, I think, basically saw that it was unfair. And so he refused to pay these bills that the OPD kept sending him. And so at a certain point, they escalated their approach. And it's no longer there. I think it's now been replaced basically with high-end housing. But there used to be a kitty corner from Jeffrey's. There used to be something called the Merchant's Garage, which was a real, you know, it was really important that people had a place to safe place to park their cars when they came from East Oakland or West Oakland or North Oakland to go out for a night. And so from the very beginning of having his club on 14th Street, Jeffrey rented that space, and the police basically went over there and falsely told the garage owner that they had evidence, which they later explained that they did not, of drug dealing and fights in the garage. And so the garage owner severed their contract with Jeffries. And again, it was another way of putting the squeeze on him that made it just harder and harder to do business. But I think that the last point I want to make is that, you know, you've got everything from, again, very bureaucratic, paper pushery kind of logics of, well, you know, if there are X number of calls for police service to your venue, then you're responsible for the overtime costs, all the way to the police straight up fabricating evidence in order to, you know, in order to sever his contract with the garage. But the upshot of both of them is that they made it extremely hard for him to do business, you know, and the city could eventually say, like, we didn't take away Jeffrey's permit, and they didn't. But they basically made it impossible for him to operate as he previously had.
And we're not going to have time, but you also simultaneously talk about another historic club that was getting similar type of treatment, which was Sweet Jimmy's. And many people who are younger would go, "Oh, I remember Sweet Jimmy's. That's what Keep the Sneak in them would perform." But Sweet Jimmy's at this time is a blues club.
Yeah, originally it was, yeah.
It has a very different crowd than Jeffrey's, and yet it was going through the same scrutiny. And both these folks, these owners, sued the city. I mean, sued the city, and wound up being before the same judge who was very favorable to the police, which I thought was interesting. But the irony, which you point out, and then I'll leave it at that, was how Sweet Jimmy's, gets sold and becomes the new parish. And and the new parish says, "We're not going to do rap shows and all that." And Michael and Jason, who we all knew, they come out of hip hop culture, and they certainly pull no
They
punches
did.
in having, hip hop shows and all that. But you show the cost that it was costing one group of people, like $15,000 a night, to somebody doing an entire festival at Mosswood Park, where they're having, day long of rock festivals, and paying like a few thousand dollars. It's crazy how you laid all that out. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. We ain't even got into Barbecue Becky and, all the other things that you cover, but we gotta go.
We do. But it's been, I mean, it's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Anything that you want people to really get out of the book when they read it? Is there something that we didn't hit that you say, "When you read this, I want you to come away with this"?
I think I want people to come away with a different kind of attunement to sound and how political and how politicized sound is. And then when I say sound, I mean, you know, certainly music. In this book, I talk a lot about different genres of black dance music in particular. That's what I'm focused on. But it's also not just music, right? We're also talking about, you know, how people yuck it up with each other in public space, you know, the sound of their cars, the sounds of their exhaust pipes, things like that. And, I feel like in some ways it kind of gets taken for granted when we think about kind of struggles over a city like Oakland. But on the other hand, it's deeply visceral. It's everywhere. It's every day. And so I hope that people come away from this book thinking more critically about sound as a kind of medium for political struggle, especially for racial political struggle and the black freedom struggle in Oakland, as well as wherever they're reading this book.
Yeah, and one thing that you do excellently is you don't separate the music from the politics. And I think the industry often will just play the music, leave the politics out of it. But in every page, the music is political, and from Jump Street, there's no escaping the politics of it. And I think with the chapter, which is why I wanted to talk about that chapter of the clubs, to see what Jeffries and Sweet Jimmy's went through, to see it replaced with the new parish and the festival, the Burger Festival at Mosswood Park, to see how that it just crystallizes what it is. We can have black expression, but it can't be black owned and black controlled. Too much of
And
that, right? too much of that in. And if somebody else is doing it, thumbs up, and we'll say, now we have a good crowd. Now we have good, respectable people. And I don't know how much more respectable you could get than somebody like Jeffries, or or Sweet Jimmy Ward when he was alive. It's like,
Yeah, respectability did not, I think, protect Jeffrey in the end.
no. Alex Wirt, we appreciate you coming on our show. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. The name of the book is called On Loop: Black Sonic Politics in Oakland. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.